Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, Taro, inside the rbeats.com studio, rbeatz.com. There's a lot of talk right now about song plagiarism, mainly because Robert Plant and Jimmy Page are standing before a judge. But plagiarism is nothing new. Who better to know that than the author of Sounds Like Teen Spirit? We are Unplugged and Totally Uncut with Tim English. Boy, what an exciting time for your book to step forward and kind of shed some light on something that's been taking place for a very, very long time.
Yeah, subject never gets old, and this is a new edition of the book that originally came out about 10 years ago, and it's got all the new cases and since then, and a lot of other things are more I didn't include the first time, so it's a lot of fun for any music fan, I can guarantee you.
As that on-air talent, that jock that would play music late at night, I always used to sit there and think, is any of this even original? Would Beethoven and Mozart come back and get a lot of people for plagiarism?
Yeah, I mean, they used to take, like, folk melodies, and then they'd orchestrate them. And, you know, I actually have a little section in the book on classical music. Paul Simon's American Tune is based on a classical music piece. But they would do the same thing. I mean, if you really step back, the whole history of music is oral tradition, isn't it? I would have a tune, and I would go to your town, and I'd play it for you. Then I'd move on, then you'd take it and change it around, and that's how the music was kept alive. We've only had, you know, we had written music, but we've only had, you know, the sound, recorded sound for about 100 years or so, right? So you've got this whole oral tradition, and now it's overlaid with, you know, intellectual property rights and copyrights and lawyers and corporations. So it creates a lot of conflict from time to time.
And yet, where the strange twist comes in so many times, I mean, we've heard the things about Stairway to Heaven and most recently with Ed Sheeran, but yet now you've got Kevin Cronin and REO Speedwagon, who it's blatantly their song is in a new Pitbull song, but I don't see anybody rushing off to court.
I'm assuming, because that is so obvious, that they cleared that before. I'm assuming that they did. I would find it hard to believe, because Pitbull has done that with other songs. I haven't looked that up, but I would be almost certain that they had gotten clearance on that before putting it out.
But to the average listener, though, it's like the average listener doesn't realize what's going on. All they hear is that, oh my God, Stairway to Heaven's in court.
Yeah, I mean, really, you're trying, you know, it's funny, as a songwriter, like, people ask, well, is it hard to be original? You know, it's kind of analogous to the manager that goes out to, you got bases loaded, the manager tells the pitcher, this is a songwriter's task, is similar, you know, don't give him anything good to hit, but don't walk him. Like, the songwriter, you want to have something that's familiar, sort of, and pleasing to the ear, but you don't want to have something that's copying something else. You have to sort of thread that needle, and it's difficult to do, but it's not impossible.
Oh my God, that whole entire thing you just said, it just all of a sudden I had a visual of the whole entire disco era. There were so many songs that sounded alike.
Yeah, there were. You know, it's really all through the whole, in the book, I really look at the whole history of rock and roll era. I mean, going back to the first song of the rock era, Rock Around the Clock, the first melody for that was lifted from Hank Williams' 1947 song, Move It On Over, that people know from George Thorogood's version now. But, you know, this is just, it's been an ongoing thing. And what I try to do in the book is show, you know, whatever your favorite artist is, whether it be Springsteen or the Beatles or the Stones, like, where did they get their ideas? What were they listening to? And really a theme of the book is that creative people are influenced by a broad range and often very surprising sources.
Weren't a lot of the the Beatles songs, just old British skiffles and bar tunes that people would just sing while swigging it down?
Well, they were influenced by everything. I mean, if you listen to the Beatles at the BBC albums, I mean, that was kind of a lot of the songs that they covered early on in their club days. And you got country on there. You've got Broadway show tunes. You've got, obviously, R&B. You've got, even oddball stuff like an Italian song, the Honeymoon song. I mean, they listened to everything. And they, obviously put their own spin on it. It's a great thing about the book, though, is it's kind of an interactive experience now where anybody, no matter how obscure the original song, people can hear it for themselves on YouTube. And if you want to have a mind blower, I mean, listen to a song called Do One to Others by American blues guy named Pee Wee Crayton. The Beatles lifted note for note the introduction of that for Revolution. Likewise, both John Lennon and George Harrison admitted that the Bobby Parker's 1961 song called Watch Your Step was where they got the riff from I Feel Fine. Bobby Parker was a pretty obscure American R&B guy from Washington, D.C. The record only got to about number 60 in the U.S. But here's John Lennon over in Liverpool, a great music fan, picking up on it, both that and Pee Wee Crayton, and incorporating it into his music. So I tell a lot of those stories where people can hear the records for themselves. It's pretty cool. Kind of provide an aha moment for people.
Speaking of Lennon, inside your book, you kind of bring out the light when it comes to his infamous song, Imagine.
Billy, a lot of people tell me that's their favorite story of the book, and I'm just kind of a head scratcher on that one, where Imagine, if you listen to it, it's very similar musically and sort of the stately tone of it too, to this novelty record, I would call it, that a cash-in record that a producer made with his father in 1965. It's called That's My Life, My Love, and My Home. Of course, his father was washing dishes at a hotel outside of London, had been estranged from John at that time for many years. And a producer over there named Cartwright said, let's get this guy and put out a record to cash in on the Beatles' fame. And even the title of it was sort of a play on it, In My Life. This was That's My Life. But if you listen to this thing, it's absolutely unbelievable, Arrow. The chords, the sort of the stately tone, are very similar to what John did in Imagine some 6 years later. And they've said that John played his father's record for friends as kind of a goof or a laugh, so he was certainly aware of it. There's another story that he had Brian Epstein ask people not to play it because it was sort of embarrassing, but he was certainly aware of it, and who knows, maybe in some Freudian way, his father's record was in the back of his mind when he was composing Imagine.
The coolest thing about your book is that you take listeners beyond the lyrics, and that's what I love about your book. It's almost like a modern-day album cover, because now it will be trained to go back and listen to those songs even closer instead of just something we've popped onto the iPod.
Well, I'm a music nerd, and there was nothing I don't have that much time to do for now, but it's nothing I would like enjoy better than having a box set and reading about the artists and the songs and while you're listening to the music. So and I try to provide information for people that they're not going to get anywhere else. I mean, you could read 20 Beatles books and you're not going to find out some of the information they have in this book. I mean, if you just kind of regurgitate what's already out there, what's the point? Why bother? So I try to write a book that I'd want to read myself as a music fan, and I can guarantee people will find out a lot of cool new information in the book.
So what is the difference between sampling and actually plagiarizing music? Are they buying that sample? Because, I mean, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. I mean, that right there, Ice Ice Baby, was a Queen David Bowie tune.
Yeah, it was, and they got sued over that. I don't think that was a sample. I think they actually played it, but what they played was close enough where it was a ripoff of the copyright infringement. That goes back to 1990, and that was sort of the Wild West days of sampling, where people would use samples without getting clearance. As a result of a couple of court cases in the early 90s, though, that changed, where they basically said if you're going to use a sample, you better get clearance for it beforehand. I mean, interesting story in the book, if you recall the Verve song called Bittersweet Symphony.
Yes.
They had, that is from a symphonic version of the Rolling Stones song The Last Time. It doesn't sound anything like The Last Time, but that's what it was, that their manager had recorded with Andrew Lou Goldham with an orchestra in the mid-60s. He was kind of an aspiring Phil Spector. But when the Verve went to use this very cool sample, which really forms the basis of their song Bittersweet Symphony, they got the permission to use the recording, but they neglected to clear the publishing, which was owned by, believe it or not, Alan Klein. He owns the Stones manager in the 60s. He owned all the Stones publishing of all their 60s stuff. Figure that out, how he was the manager and then he owned the publishing. So the Verve have this song all ready to go, and they have to beg for mercy from Alan Klein, the shrewdest, baddest, most brilliant, devious manager in music history. The chairman of, I believe it was EMI, actually got on a plane to fly to New York, and Alan Klein said, no, I'm not going to give you permission. Then the next day, he said, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a check for $1,000 you can give to Richard Ashcroft and the Verve, and in exchange, you give me the publishing, and that's what happened. So the Verve, by failing to get clearance on that sample, they gave up the publishing to the biggest song of all time, I'm sure it generated for APCO, which is Alan Klein's company, hundreds of thousands of dollars. So, that's an example of how you really need to get clearance on these things before you use them.
Wasn't Klein also involved with the George Harrison My Sweet Lord song?
Yeah, he was, because he was George's manager at that time, and George got sued because the DJs in this country, when My Sweet Lord was a big hit in early 71, they would start playing that back-to-back with He's So Fine, the 1963 oldie by the Chiffons. That case dragged on, really, for decades, believe it or not, and one of the things behind it was that Klein was supposed to be George's manager, but behind the scenes he had bought out the company that was suing him, the rights to the song by Bright Music. So he was kind of playing two sides against the middle, and George didn't appreciate that, and that was one of the reasons the case carried on for so long. In defending that case, George said he wasn't trying to write, he wasn't inspired by He's So Fine, but rather by the Edwin Hawkins singer's gospel hit from 1969, Oh Happy Day. He said if you play them, it's the same chords. He also said that, the fact that if the My Sweet Lord was a hit because of these few notes from the Chiffon song, how come Billy Preston's version of My Sweet Lord, which was produced by George, with the Edwin Hawkins singers backing him, by the way, and came out some months before George's version of My Sweet Lord came out, how come that wasn't a hit, if it was dependent on that music? Maybe the fact that My Sweet Lord was a hit depended on it was recorded by a member of the most famous band in the world. But he ended up losing that case, at least the initial judgment. And the two songs do sound quite alike. I mean, the judge said it was exactly the same song, not only the three note title phrase, but also the modulation that comes after that. If you listen to it, that's quite similar too. And I really think that case put a crimp on George's songwriting in some ways, where you have to sort of be worried that you might get sued. Of course, he recorded this song some years later about that exact topic.
Well, I mean, if I were a songwriter today, I would be horrified because, I mean, look at Ed Sheeran, and there are several songs that I hear from Jason Mraz, I swear, are lifted from other songs we've had in the past.
Yeah, and, as I say, I mean, you can hear songs that sound alike, but unless they generate a lot of income, as is the case with Blurred Lines or in the Zeppelin case going on now, the more income that's potentially at stake, the more likely you are to get a lawsuit. I mean, there are many cases I have in the book where songs sound very much alike and they never generate a lawsuit because the song wasn't a big hit. The song accused of ripping off the other was not a big hit, and there's just no money to be made for the lawyers or the plaintiffs. That'll be a shocker, that money actually plays a role in which song gets a lawsuit, which doesn't.
Well, I mean, back in the 1980s when the Bee Gees were hauled into court because of the song How Deep Is Your Love, it wasn't artist against artist. It was an unknown artist who happened to do what's called the poor man's copyright. He didn't win the case, but it still drew a lot of attention.
And for that reason, most of these major artists now will have a policy, or at least say they will, that they don't listen to material, unsolicited material from outside songwriters, unless something like that happened, where you get some guy who says, hey, man, you ripped off my song. Don't you remember I sent it to you a couple of years ago? So they kind of build a wall around themselves to say, you know, that they don't listen to any outside material, so they can just show these guys the door when they show up claiming that they got ripped off after sending a song in. You know, it's very important to prove any of these plagiarism cases. You have to prove access, i.e. that the person accused of stealing it could have heard the song in question. And, you know, that's why they have those policies of not listening to outside material.
So does it hurt Led Zeppelin that every late night host is on the air comparing the songs? Or is this something that only the judge can decide on?
Well, it's actually in front of a jury.
Oh,
and,
boy.
You know, I think you're really rolling the dice if you get these cases in front of a jury. Many times we see, as in the case with Tom Petty and Sam Smith, over Smith ripping off Petty's I Won't Back Down for his huge hit, Stay With Me. These are settled out of court, often with a gag order, in the Petty case that got leaked last year. But you get it in front of a jury. If you have to prove a couple things, you got to prove access. I think in the Zeppelin case, the plaintiffs have done a pretty good job of proving that. First of all, the Taurus song was released on a major label that got up to about 40 or 50 on the charts. Zeppelin played shows with them. Zeppelin, as they actually played the recording of this, and people can find it on YouTube. Zeppelin actually covered another song on the first Spirit album called Fresh Garbage. They actually played that in concert, and they played that recording for Page last week, you know, because Page was saying, well, I wasn't familiar with that album. It kind of strains credibility, in my opinion, if you're saying that you don't. So then you, once you have the access proved, then you got to prove substantial similarity. That's a two-part test. Part one is complete. Not, I would say it's very subjective. It's what a typical person thinks these songs sound alike. And part two is try to be more objective standard, where they bring in kind of battling musicologists, and they go over the notes, the chord progressions, the time signatures, etc. Each side will have one saying they do sound alike, or they, and the other side will have it so they don't. So it really gets down to quite a subjective thing once you get these things in front of a jury of non-musicians. And I think it's a roll of the dice. It's hard to know how a jury's going to decide. I think in this case, you're talking about only maybe at most a quarter of the song, Stairway to Heaven, because it's one section of it that's in question. The rest of the song sounds absolutely nothing like the song Taurus by Spirit.
Oh, absolutely, because Jimmy Page, the way that he describes how that song creates, I love the way that he goes in there and he talks about how it opens up. It's a continuing journey. And the more and more that I heard Jimmy Page talking about that song and when he's describing it, it's all of a sudden it's like it's just a page, basically, of what this song is. It's not the entire book.
No, it's just the it's the introduction. I don't know. It's a maybe 2 minute similarity or a minute and a half. It's certainly not the whole song. Absolutely not.
So I heard a rumor last year that One Direction had lifted a guitar riff from a Who song, and Pete Townsend was asked, please just be thankful that your music is growing forward into a new generation. Was that true, or do you see a lot more of that going forward, where the artists are going, this is awesome, just let it be, let it be?
Well, Tom Petty had that. The Chili Peppers recorded a song called Danny California. A lot of people thought it sounded like his song Last Dance with Mary Jane. And Petty was like, oh, that's cool, you know. I mean, if you're somebody like Tom Petty, you don't really want to have a image of being a litigious guy, a guy who's on the phone to lawyers. He's got such a laid-back image. I think he'd rather deal with it in that case. But in the case of Sam Smith, I mean, I think the song was so similar. He basically took Petty and Jeff Lynne, who was his co-author of I Won't Back Down, he basically took the melody and had a huge hit with it. I don't really think Petty had any choice than to defend his work in the way he did. It's funny you mentioned Pete Townsend. There's nothing I've ever found on him. If any, he's complete, very, very much an original songwriter. There's nothing in his work that you can point to and say, hey, he took that or this. You know, he's very much hard to spot his influences in his work, unlike a lot of some of the other people we're talking about, namely Led Zeppelin.
Is there anything seriously wrong with borrowing a riff? I mean, you can walk into any Sam Ash or Guitar Center, and they're all in there just doing their own thing and, you know, trying to be discovered. You know something's going to be lifted somewhere along the line.
And one of them is probably playing the introduction of Stairway to Heaven.
Yeah, I'm shocked that nobody walks into a guitar store and says, hey, wait a second here. You're part of the atmosphere of this store. Did you pay ASCAP BMI fees to be sitting here playing that song?
Yeah, well, hopefully we don't get to that. You know, the thing that's really driving this, there was a Supreme Court decision 3 years ago, and the plaintiffs in the Taurus Stairway case kind of tied bringing this lawsuit to the re-release of the early Zeppelin albums, including the fourth one with Stairway to Heaven. Basically, the Supreme Court said that even if it goes back many years, if it's continuing infringement, you can sue over it. The case they decided had to do with a screenplay for the movie Raging Bull that went all the way back to the 1960s. But obviously, Raging Bull is still making money all these years later, and so is Stairway to Heaven. So they said, well, you can still sue if it's continuing infringement. So that's sort of what compelled this case a couple years ago.
And through all of this, we do have to give kudos to Weird Al, because I guess he's played by the rules with everything he's done.
Yeah, I think he had to get permission for all that stuff that he did, you know, to do his wacky cover versions of things. But who can forget Eat It?
Well, it's a brilliant book, and the more you get to share your message today and as we grow forward with this court case, the more that your book is just going to be the place to go to identify the history of music. And we need books like this because we can't forget this, the original sounds.
And the book is a lot of fun. I can assure people it's not a bunch of courtroom drama and legalese. It's basically just pointing out two songs and one that may have influenced the other, and finding out sort of some musical ancestry of who influenced who and that type of thing. And as I say, it's kind of an interactive experience where people can compare and contrast the two songs for themselves online now and see if they think they're alike or not.